Good afternoon and welcome to the Experts Forum, FTI Consulting Compass Lexicon broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Dr. Craig Lewis, the Madison S. Wigginton Professor of Finance at Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management and moderator for today's program. The Experts Forum series is made possible through a partnership between FTI Consulting, Compass Lexicon, and the SEC Historical Society. FTI Consulting is a global business advisory firm dedicated to helping organizations protect and enhance enterprise value in an increasingly complex legal, regulatory, and economic environment, with more than 4,000 employees located in 26 countries. FTI Consulting professionals work closely with clients to anticipate, illuminate, and overcome complex business challenges in areas such as investigations, litigation, mergers and acquisitions, regulatory issues, reputation management, strategic communications, and restructuring. Compass Lexicon is internationally recognized as a leading economic consulting firm with preeminent competition, finance, intellectual property, international arbitration, and energy practices with more than 400 professionals in 18 offices around the world. Compass Lexicon offers a global perspective on economic matters and is wholly owned subsidiary of FTI Consulting. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the preeminent online source for original and primary material on the regulation of the capital markets. This afternoon's program is the second in a series discussing cutting-edge issues at the intersection of finance, economics, and regulation. I was privileged to moderate the inaugural broadcast last year examining Dodd-Frank derivatives and structured finance. This broadcast is permanently available in the Experts Forum section under programs in the virtual museum and archive, and I recommend you recommend accessing it after today's broadcast. Our topic today is the impact of falling oil prices on financial reporting. Joining with me are Christopher Champion, Vice President, Chief Accounting Officer, and Controller at Anadarko Corporation in the Woodlands, Texas. Chris formerly served as a national audit leader for oil and natural gas at KPMG LLP and has more than two decades of accounting experience. Gary Goolsby, Senior Managing Director at FTI Consulting, is based in Houston. Gary has over 40 years of accounting and auditing experience and has provided professional services to oil and gas exploration industries. David Woodcock, a partner in the securities litigation and SEC enforcement practice of Jones Day in Dallas. David was previously regional director of the SEC's Fort Worth regional office and chair of the SEC's National Financial Reporting and Auditing Task Force. Welcome, and we'd like to begin with Gary Goolsby, who is going to provide a brief history of the fluctuation of oil prices.
Well, thank you, Greg. I think it's important for us to discuss briefly the history of where oil prices have been since the early 1970s. I think this is critical because we've seen a dramatic decline in the price of over 50% over about the last year and a half. So I think putting this in perspective, just as a backdrop, would be helpful. If you go back to 1973 and the OPEC's oil embargo against the United States and Western Europe for support of Israel, the price of oil went from $4 to $10 between October 1973 and March 1974, and this is not inflation-adjusted numbers. Well, then what happened? The Iranian Revolution and Iran-Iraq War came in with Iran cutting production, canceling contracts with U.S. companies, and Iraq's production decline. The price of oil went from $15 to $40 in April 1980. So you're seeing some dramatic increases given the economics of what was occurring at the time. Other countries started filling the gap during this period of time, resulting in overproduction. And then we came into the 1980s with the price dropping to $13 in March of 1986. And many of you may recall, the early mid-1980s was a very difficult period for the oil and gas industry. Many have compared what's going on today with that time frame. But that was a period of time when there was massive layoffs in the industry, difficult problems, liquidity issues resulting from, again, the overproduction and the drop in the price of oil. In 1990, obviously the Iraq invasion of Kuwait occurred, and the price of oil went from $18 in July 1990 to $36, doubling in October 1990. Then as the Asian financial crisis occurred in 1997, the global demand for oil falling, the price declined from $25 to $12 in 1999. But then further strengthening of the global economies led to a high demand for oil with low supply, resulting in oil reaching $134 in 2008. As you can see, this ebb and flow of economic demand and supply, wars and political events is causing erratic movement in the price of oil over time. And then, as we all remember, the global financial crisis that started in 2008 resulted in the price of oil declining back down to $41. Eventually, the global economies again recovered, and oil reached up to $106 a barrel in 2012. And that brings us to where we are today. The most recent decline over the past year and a half or so has resulted from increased oil supply driven by increasing global production, including the shale activities that's occurred. Plus, demand has been declining due to slow growth in Asia and Europe, and the U.S. dollar has been strengthening. So we've seen a decline now, I think, today to about $41 a barrel. And many think it will continue low for the foreseeable future. But as you can see from history, we really don't know what's going to happen to the price because of all the erratic movement that's occurred in the issues that can impact the price of oil over time. But for sure, the world uses 93 million barrels of oil a day, plus or take some, and produces around 93, 94 million barrels of oil a day, which are huge numbers. But the movement of production and reserves that's on stream and that's in the, still in the ground can still have a dramatic impact on the price of oil and has driven it low, as we've seen.
Great. Thank you, Gary. At this point, I'd like to ask the panel to contribute. You know, the one thing that I think we can take away from your comments that we know about oil pricing is that it's volatile. It's been high, it's been low, and it will continue to do so in the future. I was hoping we could answer a few questions. One would be, how long do we think oil prices are likely to stay where they are? Talk about some of the geopolitical consequences of the current state of the market, and just give us what you think some of the implications are for the industry as a whole.
The only thing I would say is just sort of the quote from Daniel Yergin, which is, cycles of shortage and surplus characterize the entire history of oil. That's basically what Gary just went through, and I think it's true. It will always be true.
Your first question is how long is this going to last? And I guess first off, my views I say here today are mine and not necessarily the company I work for. But, you know, when all this started last Thanksgiving, there's a general presumption that this is going to be a year, right? The second half of 15 towards, you know, basically where we are now, that we would expect that we'd be coming up the curve a little bit. What happened over the summers through the fall is that, you know, there's a sort of a second dip, and, you know, this tag phrase that's catching is, you know, lower for longer. Is not going to be V-shaped. It's going to be something more than that. And so the question is, when does it recover? And you know, when we look at the world today, I mean, just you think about the Russians are bombing in the Middle East, has no impact on the price of oil, right? We're seeing production stay relatively flat because people are able to drill and do more with less. And so when will this supply demand balance come back? And it's, you know, it's one thing that Gary talked about, you know, the 93 million barrels of oil and how much demand there is. But, you know, there's inventories. There's over 300 million barrels of inventory right now. There's a lot of drilled and uncompleted wells. And so that all needs to work through the system. And so, you know, I'll put something out there that, you know, my personal view, I'm hoping that sometime mid-17 or late 17, we're starting to see some kind of recovery. And recovery might be more than $50, $55. You know, the one other point I'll add here is we talk about oil a lot, but natural gas is sort of the forgotten child here in a way. You know, when you think about natural gas in the U.S., since year-end, the five-year strip has decreased 25%. It's actually decreased more than oil strip has. And you think about, you know, El Nino and the warmer winter. You think about the inventory levels we have here. And you know, what is the outlook for natural gas? And one would say that even as oil comes back, there's a lot of associated gas along with that as well. And so, yeah, I think for natural gas, it might not be lower for longer. It might be lower for longer and longer. So who knows when that will come back.
So, Chris, for those of us who aren't quite as familiar with oil and gas, what do you mean when you say a strip?
So there's a five-year curve that's traded. So that is the market view. So at any one point in time, you know, whether that fifth year has the liquidity to say that's really going to be the price in 5 years, some would doubt. It's certainly very valid for 3 years. And when you look at the five-year strip for oil, it doesn't give above $60 as it stands today.
And again, the other issue that I had mentioned is there's so many interacting forces here that one has to consider and think about that you never really know how it's going to impact the price of oil. World economies are down. The Fed has left our interest rates basically zero because world economies are slow. That has dramatic impact on demand, China, India, other countries. Political environments that we discussed in history can impact that price. There are just so many things that can impact what's going on here. And the point is here, as we'll get into later in the discussion today, is this price decline for foreseeable future is having dramatic impacts on strategies, accounting, disclosure, and issues that's impacting so many in the industry, some positive, some negative.
There's a couple of, sort of getting away from the regulatory questions of what the regulators might do here, when this is going to end. Even regardless of the length of time this happens, there's been a noticeable shift in behavior amongst the participants in the production and exploration. And that is when times are tough, right, issues that would have been worked out more easily start to get escalated more. And, you know, I guess it's fair to say there's a more litigious environment. But you're also seeing a lot more in that regard. Royalty, working interest owner litigation, JV audit litigation. You're seeing insolvencies effect on litigation posture, right? And if you signed a contract that was profitable at $80, $90, or $100 a barrel, and you're now locked into that contract for the next few years, one option, an unfortunate option, may be insolvency, which is not something a lot of people want to do. I think those are the things that are happening now as far as I can see, and this is the short term. If it bounces back, and there are a lot of people who think it will bounce back quickly, right? There's been a lot of money raised. E&P companies have raised a lot of money recently, and there are a lot of private equity funds and others who are investing in this space, probably in the hopes that a lot of this is temporary and that prices are going to rebound. And so they're betting on better outlooks and trying to get cheap assets while they're down. But if that prolongs, right, then that bet becomes upside down and not good. And I think we talked about kind of the effect. We've talked a little bit about the effect. I think these statistics are hard to come by, accurate statistics, but I've seen upwards to 200,000 people have lost their jobs in the global oil and gas industry. I'm not sure how many have lost them in the United States, but it's a lot of people, a lot of layoffs. You know, those have ripple effects, and they're not happening necessarily only at the large E&P companies. They're happening at the service provider level, the companies who are the sort of downstream, the pressures on them, right? And I think the longer this lasts, the more of those you see, and the more difficult the environment becomes for everybody, eventually including some of the larger companies that can operate in lower price environments may not be able to operate at the same level for long.
So can anybody maybe contribute to sort of the geopolitical consequences or the underlying motivations that countries like Saudi Arabia and the Middle East have to keeping oil prices at the levels they are today?
Well, I'll make a comment. I guess we all know that Saudi Arabia has decided not to slow their production. They continued their production. And the thought was that many believe they're doing this to drive other operations out of business, such as the oil shale activity in the United States, that they keep the price low enough it becomes uneconomical. And therefore, that reduces supply, and we're back to the supply and demand concept, obviously, and the supply will drop and the price will go back up. It's interesting, though, that, again, this gets complex because a lot of these countries have become dependent upon the cash flow from oil, and now even Saudi Arabia is borrowing money to finish projects. Now, they do have substantial reserves, obviously, in dollars, but they are borrowing money to finish projects rather than using, you know, the current cash flow out of their sales. So I think that when you look at that, the impact of Iran, the unknown issues there, obviously Libya, you've had a lot of turmoil, and their exports were nothing for many months, on over a year perhaps. So you get all these factors swirling on the geopolitical front around the world that any one of these can affect the price of oil, and they will at some point. But it's yet to be seen just the final result of all that over time.
On that note about Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabia's Vice Minister of Petroleum and Mineral Resources, in a speech a couple maybe last week, talked about the ratio of spare capacity to oil consumption. And he was talking about the comparison between, say, the 1980s, the mid-80s oil crisis, and the current crisis. And he was saying, you know, the comparison is really not well taken. It's really misguided, because the ratio of share capacity to global oil consumption in 85 was 17%. Today, it's about 2%. And that just tells you Saudi Arabia, despite low prices, or maybe in turn to encourage low prices, has not taken its foot off the pedal, so to speak, of production. And you have that supply being sustained in the face of really remarkable growth in the U.S. Production and capabilities, all coming along the lines on the heels of slowdown, or what we believe to be slowdown, in China and most of the rest of the world, frankly. And then even in the U.S., growth has been around 2.2 or something like that percent GDP for the last few years. So you've got a lot of supply and very little and possibly slowing demand, but people not willing to. They're making a bet, it seems to me, about who can last the longest.
That's right. So it's almost as if the two forces are interacting to push prices even lower,
right?
You have excess supply, or more supply than maybe is warranted. At the same time, you have countries demanding less oil.
All for the geopolitical reasons you asked about originally. And I can't say what, you know, how those will shake out or what those actually are, but I suspect that's what's driving a lot of this.
Okay. So we're going to... What I'd like to do now is maybe transition from sort of that sort of macro view of oil and concentrate a little more on some of the key accounting issues that exist for oil and gas companies. And I thought maybe, Chris, if you could talk to us about kind of what's happening today and in the future.
So it's certainly a very active time for all companies. And when we talk about oil and gas, sometimes we focus on the upstream companies, but it's really across the value chain. So when you think about the drillers and the oil field services companies, I mean, they're really the tip of the spear here. When they're the first ones to see the shock when you do have a big price dislocation that we had. And so for those companies, I mean, the issues are pretty much the same. It's just the timing of when they impact the particular companies. David mentioned layoffs, and so there's certainly accounting that goes with that and shutting down businesses as well. But a lot of this has to do with asset valuation. A lot of these oil field services companies and even E&P companies have been in growth mode for the last decade, and there's a lot of goodwill on the books and high asset values. And so if you step back and look at what's transpired in the last year, I certainly didn't have time to go look at the amount of value that's been written off balance sheets. But certainly within this third quarter, let's focus on the service companies first. I don't know if there was a company out there that either didn't have an impairment or an impairment of goodwill, right? And so when you think about these assets, some of these are drilling rigs. Some of these might be rigs of the era of the late 90s, early 2000s that were perfectly good operating rigs. But now that there's a new class of rig that's come on, and if they're available, no one's going to be going back to older technology. And so, I was on a fishing trip in South Louisiana a month ago, and was driving along the coast right there by Sabine Pass, and saw probably no less than 12 jackup rigs sitting in port. Well, that's certainly not a place where you want them to be. And so they're certainly feeling that pain, right? And some of them are shedding assets, which brings on disclosure issues. When you go to E&P, it is difficult. This goal of having one set of global financial standards. When you get within the E&P sector, there's actually three right now, and going to one might be tough. But, yeah, we have the full cost accounting, which is birthed by the SEC pretty much. That's still out there. We have successful efforts. And then, you know, we have IFRS, and the oil and gas is an international play here. And it's interesting to follow the timing and the amount of impairments for each three of these different methods. When you look at full cost, when there's an impairment, and there's been significant this quarter, but it's not based on fair value. It's a 12-month look back. It's the price you look at, right? And so when we're sitting there at December 31st of 2014, the full cost companies, for the most part, weren't taking impairments because they had three-quarters of their year was $90-plus dollar oil, right? And so, you know, certainly as the years come through and those high prices drop off, you're starting to see, you know, huge impairments. But, again, they're not based on fair value. Then you have successful efforts, which has an undiscounted cash flow model, which is nice to have. And, you know, a lot of this depends on how these companies acquired these assets. You know, were they organic? Were they acquired? And you start seeing some impairments fourth quarter last year, but mainly through this year. And the third quarter was, I would say, a bloodbath for successful efforts. You know, there's some that had already taken their pain, but, you know, the strip alone from, you know, let's call March was a low water mark, so to speak. Well, it was down 15% even from March, so at September 30th. So you saw these huge impairments, but they're based on fair value. Once you get past undiscounted cash flow, you're based on fair value. Well, then you have IFRS, which is a totally different model. I always refer to it as you sort of pass go and go directly to jail because you don't have this undiscounting gate to hide behind. But it is different. The measurements are just a little bit different, though. It's recoverable value, which is the higher value in use, and I'll explain what that is, or fair value. And this value in use calculation is more from management's view. So it certainly has elements that you see in fair value as far as cash flows, but the pricing could be more management's view of pricing versus, you know, some might use a forward strip. And you might have some differences in discounting. So we have an accounting model that yields three different sizes of impairments, probably at different times. You know, the disclosures around there are certainly important, and I think that most people in the industry, this is unfortunately became, you know, sort of a core competency. I think around disclosures, you know, when I go and look at various companies' disclosures, they're making the right disclosures. Now, something that is very important here is that, you know, within the financial statements, there's a risk and uncertainty, used to be SOP 94.6, about when, you know, it's nice that you took these impairments, but give us a vision forward. And even within SK 303, there's about known trends. And, you know, I'm sure the SEC is very interested that, you know, if you've had material impairments today, what disclosures are you making about what could happen in the future? You know, if gas is down, I think another 5% from the end of the quarter, and if you had an asset that was barely passing at that gas price, what kind of disclosure did you put? What kind of forward-looking early warning disclosure do you put? Say, we've already taken impairments, but if it decreases further, you know, we could have additional impairments. And so I think from, you know, when people put on their financial reporting hats, it's not so much what did happen as you might need to start forecasting a little bit and giving some early warning disclosures of what could happen. As far as goodwill, you know, goodwill is sort of an interesting little thing. And I think a lot of it depends on when it came on. Certainly, we've seen the service companies take goodwill impairments, but yeah, I think their equity prices have been hit disproportionately worse than maybe some others in the industry. You know, there's this warped logic that if you take a $6 billion impairment charge on an asset, but your market cap stays flat, that actually helps you in your goodwill test, right? And so you're not seeing them as much within the E&P sector. And then we moved to midstream, and I'd say midstream is probably more of a lagger in here because, I mean, when you think about it, it is transportation, right? It's like, you know, cars on a highway. And, you know, so far, you know, we've heard that production has been staying relatively flat. Certainly, if you have assets within some shale plays that are out of favor. Well, there's Marcellus and the like that would certainly put some pressure. But at some point in the third quarter, we start to see some of the larger midstream players take impairment. If the volume's not coming through, that's the only way you're getting paid. And you hear about people laying down rigs and everything else. And so eventually, if production takes a big stair step down in the U.S., and again, depending on location, just like buying a house, location is about everything in this industry, the midstream companies are going to feel it as well.
That's something we didn't really talk about on the other piece, but it's the what you might say the evolution or devolution of the environment in the face of longer term price depression, because most of those midstream companies have longer term contracts that require a certain amount of flow through, and so your option is to pay them that amount or file bankruptcy, and if you try to sustain yourself as long as you can. But right now the midstream assets aren't really, or companies aren't really being hit quite as hard as the others, but if these prices sustain, then you'll have people kind of throwing their hands up and saying, I don't care that I have a long term contract, I can't operate under it. You're not getting any more flow through.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. It's really been probably in the last 3 or 4 months when you start looking at the equity values of the midstream. Mm-hmm. They're starting to play in this decline in somewhat disproportional manner, because I think people are starting to read the headlines. I mean, if someone's going to have 5 rigs and 2 years ago, now we're going down to 1, there's less traffic going on that highway, right?
Yeah. And most of those companies are great companies to buy. A lot of people like to buy them for the dividend or the distribution, which really depends on cash flow. So interesting to see.
The one final thing we'll talk about, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, is disclosures around oil and gas reserves. As we're coming to year end, a lot of the E&P companies, if they're public, have required disclosures. And it's going to be very interesting, because in order to have approved undeveloped reserves, so this is approved reserve but you hadn't developed it, right? You need management intent. Well, that's, you may or may not have that, depending on if I'm only running one rig, where I'm going to put that. If it's not my highest return asset, then that approved undeveloped reserve I have in this other area might not meet that. And then depending on the company's financial wherewithal. It's great that you have the intent, but do you have the capital to do it? And then you have to pass both those sort of gates in order to keep that proved undeveloped reserve on your books. And so you can start seeing this sort of daisy wheel effect, where you start debooking all these reserves, and next thing you know, it leaves an impairment. But more than anything else, people start getting worried about your underlying asset base.
Let me just ask you a question, anybody on the panel, really a question. And when you think about the current state of accounting rules that are designed to, allow firms to file, right, with the SEC, do you think they do a good job? I mean, are they adequate? Are they enough to really inform investors about what they should be able to understand when they look at the financial statements? Are some of these approaches, let's say, better than others? So we have a number of different choices we can make, right?
I'm sure everyone's going to have a different view. My view is, when you go back to when the successful efforts for rules came in 1977, you look at the basis of conclusion. There's certainly advocates back then, because this is an unusual type of accounting, because most your asset value is not on your balance sheet, right? It's down the ground, and so. Should you go to a fair value type of model here? And certainly back in 1977, they thought that was not the case. There was some thought that the FASB moving towards fair value seems like a lot of things are more based on fair value. IFRS can give you some of that. Once you trigger the impairment, you can reverse impairment. So by definition, they can fluctuate. I don't know if our financial reporting model with respect to this area is broken necessarily, because these oil and gas reserve disclosures are important. They put they're standardized, right, and that's very important, because the reason why they put there is so people can compare different companies, and everyone's going to have their own view of value, right? And so I think as long as we're giving the underlying information, Someone can put in their own model and come up with different asset values. I think if you look at analyst reports for a particular company, you know, they might be all over the place because they impute they have a different view of their forward value. So,
yeah, I would add to that. Go ahead, Gary. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I agree with what Chris is saying. I think also as a package of financial reporting, I would say it does a good job. And what a package I mean is the disclosure of the reserves like Chris is mentioning on a consistent basis, but you've also got other disclosures of risk factors. You got management's discussion and analysis, which covers all sorts of issues from liquidity to where the forward-looking information is about your company. You've got disclosures in the footnotes to the financial statements with articulating how the rules work. So I think as a package, the financial reporting model and disclosure does a good job of laying it out for investors to see. Not that there won't always be questions. There's analyst calls. People ask questions, clearly. But I think as a package, it does that. I think there's other issues you get into, but I think that – but because you get into issues, too, like internal control over financial reporting. As you go through a period where people lay off individuals, you worry about internal controls. But that's accommodated through disclosure. There's required Sarbanes-Oxley disclosure on internal controls over financial reporting. Do they work appropriately or not, or do you have a material weakness? So taking all this as a package, I think it does a reasonably good job of communicating to stakeholders – and users, the information that's included.
I think that's I agree with both comments. Very good points, especially the total package piece. I think, you know, the SEC's disclosure rules are designed to be agnostic as to the merits of any particular business model or approach. It's really they're designed to get information to investors. There's been some criticism recently that maybe there's too much information included, and when you start talking about the total package, you've got, you know, the risks, you've got all of the MD&A, you've got the financial data, you know, the average, I don't know what the average size of the 10K annual report is, but it's several hundred pages, I believe, and that's a lot of material. So the question is, are you getting the right material in the right way to investors? And I think, you know, the disclosure rules try to do that. You know, we're talking about oil and gas here specifically. You know, the rules were, not my word, their word, modernized in late 2008, 2009, whatever, when they implemented. And so, you know, the design there is to make them more meaningful to investors. And the way the SEC does rule changes is by proposing rules and then putting them out to comment. And they got lots of comments on these particular rules. So while, you know, they're certainly nothing is perfect, I think they try to get the right information to people who need to make decisions about investing or analyzing companies.
Great. So that may have been an awkward way to try to transition into the next point, but I was wondering, in your view, David, what do you feel was sort of some of the key accounting risks? Your work at the SEC certainly spent a lot of time looking at some of these issues, so maybe you could tell us a little bit about the SEC approach and sure. some of the areas of focus and how they review oil and gas financial statements and key sure. takeaways with respect to enforcement actions.
Certainly. So, you know, interesting, Chris mentioned this a second ago. I mean, accounting is obviously very important, but in this space, I think disclosures are in some ways more important. The SEC oversees accounting and disclosure issues relating to oil and gas and anybody, really in several ways, but two ways that I'll talk about right now. And that is through the review of corporate disclosures and financial statements, and then through enforcement actions. And in this space, I think it's fair to say most of the work done for publicly reporting companies is done through the review of disclosure and accounting issues. And that's done by the Division of Corporation Finance, who is required under Sarbanes-Oxley to do reviews, selective reviews of periodic filings. So these are filings that companies make, 10-Ks, 10-Qs, 8-Ks, that sort of thing. And then also transaction-based filings like IPO-related documents. And they're checking those for a couple of things. One is compliance with the securities disclosure rules. And, you know, we've talked a bit about what those are here. But also for accounting issues. And that's an enormous task, right? There's a lot of publicly traded companies, but the way CorpFin works is it's divided up by industry groups. There's a natural resources industry group, and that group has a group that is dedicated to oil and gas. And so they focus on particular industries, and they will review financial statement filings, disclosures, accounting issues. If they see something they have questions about, they'll issue a comment letter to the company. And the company will respond, and that can go back and forth, and it's really meant to be a dialogue between the company and Division of Corporation Finance. If there are accounting issues involved, not just disclosure issues, those can be elevated within the Division of Corporation Finance's own accountants, but also to the Office of Chief Accountant at the SEC, who really speaks with authority on matters of accounting at the SEC. So that's kind of the background of the review of financial disclosures and accounting that Corp Fin conducts. You know, what are they looking for? What kind of questions do they ask? Thankfully, we know some of that because they will make these comment letters and where they can, the responses publicly available. And so every year you can go back and look and get at least a good swath of what comments, what was on Corp Fin's mind. And as you might expect, reserve issues are always a big source of comments. I've seen it. I don't know if this is – I shouldn't say this because I don't know if it's 100% accurate, but I've seen people estimate that for a typical E&P company, reserves account for about 70% of the company's value. And as Chris was saying, they're really not, you know, a financial disclosure per se. But they drive a lot of measures of corporate health, and so Corp Fin really focuses on them. So they things like finding and development costs, reserves replacement ratios, reserves life index, and depreciation, depletion, and amortization. Those are things that investors care about. Those are metrics or measures that investors care about, and a lot of that is driven from the reserves. So I think, in the interest of time, I'm going to talk a little bit about what are some of the areas they've made comments on in the past few years. I won't spend a lot of time on this. And then we'll move into sort of the enforcement side of the house, right? Some of the typical subject matter areas for comment letters have been reserves and reserve reports. These are new requirements that if you don't have to use a third party to do a reserve report, but if you do, you need to disclose certain things about it, and, you know, lots of things, including the technical competence of the person doing it or the group doing it, the technologies used to establish the additions to reserve estimates, those sorts of things. So that's an area of comment, a big area of comment. Some have said about a quarter of all comments in 2012 and 2013 relate to proved undeveloped reserves or PUDs. And a lot of overstatements that are out there are maybe more likely to occur here because they're the ones that are subject to more uncertainty. But they're also, despite the uncertainty, they're also used by investors, banks, investment banks, in terms of credit, providing credit. So there are useful metric used, and so they're an area of focus. So I could go through some of the kind of the comment letter examples, but I mean, these are things like I'm going to give you some highlights, really. Disclosure of material changes to PUDs, development of PUD reserves, disclosure of reasons why any material amounts of PUDs remain undeveloped after 5 years from the initial disclosures. So Chris talked about that 5-year limit, right? So tell us why you have any amounts left over after 5 years. You told investors you were going to develop them. Companies' disclosed rate of converting its PUDs to proved developed reserves would not support the company's contention that all of the PUDs would develop in 5 years. So if you tell me you're going to develop your PUDs at a 5% annual rate, how does that – it doesn't seem like it's going to work out to 5 years. So explain to us. And really what Corp Fin's doing here is asking you to explain how you made these disclosures. Other areas of focus on can be things like present activities like the number of wells drilled, completed, and shut in, awaiting infrastructure, costs and prices. And this is where you get into maybe a little bit more of the accounting angle as opposed to disclosure angle. But one example is, property acquisition costs, drilling costs, or impairment results, how companies treat transportation costs, how they've computed net income in connection with the company's standardized measure determination. So those are some of the other areas. So that's Corp Fin. And go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, the one thing I'll interject is in my prior life, this is pretty much where I spent most of my time is helping clients respond to these comment letters. And the one thing I'll say is that, on a proportion basis, if you're looking at an upstream E&P company, I'll put 75-80% of the comments were reserve related. And, I'll tell you, I'll put in a plug for the SEC reserve engineers because a number of times the comments that they're asking are very analytical, and they're taking something that's disclosed on page 15 in the business section and using something from MD&A and then maybe something that's back in the reserve disclosures and coming up with a very good question. And, you know, it's sort of amazing that they're doing all this just with the information provided, even though it's the way the rules are. They are in three different spots. And, you know, sometimes this gets to the point where the comment says, please send us your reserves disk, right, or everything related to this, because, you know, they might find something that looks a little bit out of sorts with proved undeveloped reserves. The next thing you know, it's turned into a real live, you know, three or four, you know, comment letters back and forth. And so just pay particular attention when you're doing your disclosures, because we can all do that the same math. And if there is something that looks out of sorts, there might be a very good reason for it. And that's your opportunity to put a little more disclosure that might save you a lot of time on the back end.
So. Yeah. And some of these comments do result in debookings, right? I mean, I think it's a good point. I mean, that's why CorpFin's aligned by industry group, because they have an expertise there. I mean, you don't want someone who focuses on banking finance to be drilling down on your questions, no pun intended, on PUDs. Mm-hmm. So that's the CorpFin side, and that's where I think is a really important component of how the SEC looks at oil and gas and regulates in this space. The Division of Enforcement is the hammer, right? That's the one that people don't really like to be engaging with the same way. You know, it's not necessarily collaborative or a dialogue, if you will. A subpoena is not exactly an invitation to a dialogue. But so on the Division of Enforcement side, really there are two kinds of at least in my mind, I divide the kinds of oil and gas cases the SEC has in two different buckets. The first is one that's probably not worth spending much time on now, and these are the private offerings where money's raised from sophisticated or investors to drill wells, right? Typically, these are set up as joint ventures, and they're really relying on Rule 506 of Regulation D as an exemption of registration. These are private offerings. They can range from $1 million, $500,000, presumably small amounts, to several hundred million dollars, right? I mean, they're nearly $1 billion in some of these, and so they're quite popular. They're quite common, and I will tell you that the SEC, most of the oil and gas cases that the SEC has filed historically have been relating to these kinds of private offerings. It probably doesn't take much of a stretch to understand why. Most of the what you might call fraud would be committed through these kinds of offerings. They're very reduced SEC registration requirements, no or very minimal state filing requirements, and then no limit on the amounts raised. And so they're often sold through what are called captive broker dealers who are set up to sell these things. And, you know, they're just always high risk. And I'm going to go without spending much time on this particular area, I guess a couple of reasons that relate to sort of the environment that we're in today as to why these might be high risk. So, if you think about it, these are often issuers of small offerings, right? And who are they competing with? If they find a well somewhere or a potential well or a lease, right, that's got some great potential, you might think that, well, one of the larger, more sophisticated shops or companies has already known about that and either passed on it. It's unlikely that a small operator is going to find something that more sophisticated companies haven't found and considered. And so these are small offerings, and they're competing with highly capitalized large energy companies to locate and execute these leases on drilling locations that are most likely to produce commercially viable quantities of oil and gas. That's very difficult. And I think, just to relate it back to our discussion today, you know, I think it's much tougher in a weak price environment. Right. I mean, if you think you can go rent a rig and have an operation where you're going to make you're going to be to raise $20 million, and you've got a lease with where you think you can drill some wells. Maybe there used to be operations there. Now with fracking and horizontal drilling, you think you can turn that into something. That's pretty expensive to do with very small scale. And you probably need prices to be a lot higher than maybe they are now to be profitable. So those are risky for that reason. Another one is, one of the big risks here is for the same reason. Any downward fluctuation in the price of oil and gas reduces the likelihood that well production will be offset by the expenses. And that's basically what I was just saying, which is you're spending a lot of money to do this, and it's unlikely in a low price environment that you're going to get that returned. And so they'll always be around. They are those types of investments and those types of offerings, but they're riskier. And that's where a lot of the SEC's cases come from. The other kinds, more in line with what we've been talking about today, are actions involving public companies. You know, it's interesting because there are relatively few SEC settled or filed cases against public company issuers for misstatements relating to oil and gas reserves. I mean, if you go back 15, 20 years, there are very few, I mean, a handful, really. And those cases, I won't talk about each individual case, but I will say, you know, there have been some very large ones. One in 2004 where there was an overstatement of 4.47 billion barrels of previously reported proved reserves. That's about 23%. The company ended up paying $120 million. That's sizable. You know, there have been others. There's another one from 2008 where the company reduced its previously reported proved natural gas and oil reserves by 35%. Reduced its earnings by about $1.7 billion. So that's very sizable. More recently, there were a couple of other cases, 2015 and 14, that were smaller, involved much smaller companies, much smaller amounts. But I think rather than talk about the details of any of those cases, I want to talk about kind of what all of those cases kind of take away, the takeaway from some of those, all of those cases. And one is, and Gary mentioned this earlier, and that is in all of those cases, the companies were cited for having weak internal controls. That's a standard claim in any kind of misstatement, disclosure, or accounting fraud case, but it's particularly true here and for reasons that I'll talk about. But the other thing is, in many of those cases, the management was ignoring red flags, and those red flags were either engineer reports or engineers or reports from third parties or, you know, data they were getting from the fields, right? So that if they think something's going to produce X value or X amount, and they're being told that, you know, their predictions are already off in the first or second year of something, it's probably time to adjust, and a lot of them didn't. That goes the same thing with sort of how these trends are impacting future plans. You know, how do prices and some of these, you know, you think prices might be going down, but you're trying to avoid that, and so you're keeping things on the books that you shouldn't. And that's another common theme through some of these cases. One of the, I think, a takeaway from that is, and this is easier said than done, right? I mean, this is almost feel guilty saying this, but don't unnecessarily delay writing down recorded proved reserves when the evidence requires it. Well, very few people will say that they do, but in some of these cases, that exactly what happened. Obviously, a lot of this, my own personal view on these is in every one of these cases, you had management suffering from a version of short-termism, and that is they were trying to avoid reality in some ways, because they were focused on short-term profitability, right? Or what they could tell the market. And I think that prevented them from making the right decision. So just some takeaways on what caused these overestimates: poor estimating practices. So that's unsound technical work. And then another one that was rather interesting is insufficient understanding or improper application of the SEC rules. They probably could be written better. There's no perfection there, but they're pretty clear. But a lot of, you know, that requires training. It requires people who know how to implement them. In some of these instances, you didn't have that. You didn't have people who knew the rules. You also had misguided incentives and competition for investors, which could have caused some of the overbooking. And then the human biases, such as overconfidence or being overly optimistic. That was another theme from senior management in these. You know, the last thing on this is overstatements can occur in these proved developed reserves, which many of these cases involved, but it's much more likely to occur in these proved undeveloped reserves, as I said earlier. And this is why the SEC, really in the last 5 years, has been focused on PUDs with the modernization of SEC reporting requirements in 2008. I think they started looking in 2012, maybe it was, 11 and 12, how companies were treating those PUDs that you told us 5 years ago were going to be developed in 5 years. Well, how did that turn out? And so I think they did some work on that. And I suspect you'll see more effort from enforcement on that angle as well.
So, you know, one of the some of my work has looked at sort of earnings management, and one of the things that I think is likely to be the case in many situations is that when you're in an industry where profitability is generally eroding, there are many more firms that have strong incentives to try to do things to make performance actually appear to be better than it may actually have been. And so I think, Gary, I'd like you to maybe comment a little bit about some of the challenges that face auditors when they are looking at firms in this particular right now.
Sure. The issue is anytime you've got an industry going through challenges, whether it's the financial markets crisis that occurred that was devastating in so many ways, or the decline in the price of oil, it results in the auditor being more sensitive and skeptical to the issues at hand. In other words, just some of the things that the auditor is going to pay a lot of attention to, which is no great surprise to a company that's gone through audits over and over again as public companies. But the auditor is going to reassess their risk, the risk of the accounting that Chris talked about, the risk of overstatement of assets, the risk of not booking accruals for severance when you've dismissed people, the risk of not booking assets held for sale at fair value, all those type factors in the risk factors of what impact the price of oil decline has had on the company is important. I mentioned, too, the internal control of financial reporting. This is a critical area for the auditor in a Sarbanes-Oxley. It requires management attestation as well as management assertion and auditor attestation on that assertion. Getting a declining employment base and cutting back on resources is something that will fuel the auditor's concern about that area, and we'll take a closer look to make sure things are as they should be. The other thing is the area of disclosures. We've talked about a lot of the disclosures in the footnotes a few minutes ago, but also the auditor has a responsibility for looking at disclosures outside the audited financial statements to determine if there's any material inconsistencies with what's in the audited financial statements. And some of this information is doing comparative analysis that David was talking about, looking at reserves. Is the information in there inconsistent with the ceiling test information they've been looking at? Looking at forward-looking information about liquidity of the company, the debt factors, are they going to survive as a going concern? But all those issues of disclosures are critical that the auditor is going to be looking at. The other key area here is management representations. As we all know, auditors get management representation letters from management. That represents to a lot of issues. And when you got a declining environment in your business and challenges dealing with realization of assets and other factors, the management representations become very important. But the auditor has to obviously audit those representations that are made to corroborate what's being stated there. So that's something that will get more attention as well. Clearly, communications with the audit committee are always critical. But in an environment where things are moving rapidly, and that there's not improvement being seen for the foreseeable future, the communications become even more crucial in talking to the audit committee about what the issues and risk may be. Looking at the comment letters that David mentioned is crucial in understanding where the SEC is dealing with the company's particular set of financial statements. It will also be something that the auditor will be focused on. But I think overall the key here is, again, you've got a changing economic environment, rapidly changing economic factors, an unknown horizon, and so therefore auditors are going to be more skeptical. They're going to wear a different hat in the skepticism arena to probe deeper in analyzing some of these areas to be sure the accounting's right, disclosure's right, so that the audit report reflects what it should, that everything's presented in all material respects as it should be.
I mean, it's. I don't know if you can talk to this, but one of the common ways, both with the private oil and gas offerings and in public company space, common ways to get comfortable with the estimates you're making about this inherently subjective reserve area is to use experts. I'm not talking about auditors, but I'm talking about, you know, reserve experts. And in some of the cases, some of the few cases, and in many of the private cases, where people get sideways is when they disregard what the experts say. What kind of work, if any, do the auditors do with respect to these third-party experts?
Well, there's required auditing literature that deals with using an expert and what you do in evaluating an expert. And it's not only in oil and gas reserve estimates that feed into depletion calculations, but also actuarial calculations for pensions and that sort of thing. So the auditor has to evaluate the expert, the qualifications, the expertise, the skill, the knowledge, the experience, the background, the history, the methodology, those kinds of things. Not redo what they did, not recalculate what they did, because they're not petroleum engineers in this case, but rather evaluate the credibility of those engineers to know what is being used in the calculations for the financial statements. Again, they don't audit the reserve disclosures, but those numbers feed into depletion calculations depleting the oil and gas assets. So experts do have to be considered in that way to evaluate the credibility of those experts. Chris, yeah. You may have some input.
Yeah,
from your
so recent. I did it for 22 years. So, yeah, it is. I mean, it certainly is what Gary said about evaluating experts, but it really goes beyond that. I mean, sometimes we say it's the most audited, unaudited footnote. from a standpoint that, you know, it's garbage in and garbage out, and you know, there's certain things that go in that reserve report that auditors can have a view on, right? There's pricing. I mean, it's prescribed. You can go audit that. You can look at the cost assumptions and compare it to budget. You can look at division of interest decks, which is very important. That's, you know, the company's ownership. And so, you know, when you put all that together, and then, you know, there's different forms of assurances that these third-party engineers are doing. Some are doing a methods review that is more on top. It's for, are they appropriate, doing the right methods? Some do audits, right? And that's audits taking what the company gives you and relooking at themselves. I mean, the engineers will orally tell you that, yes, they do look at operating metrics and make sure they're within the fairway of some of their other clients, but the reports don't say that. They say we take what the company gave us. And then there's a third where it is a independent buildup, right? It is a preparation of the reserve report. And so certainly with each of those, there's a different level of comfort that might change sure. The nature and timing and extent of the procedures the auditors do. But, you know, at least in my experience and practice when I was on that side of the fence, I mean, it was we spent a lot of time in that area. We communicated with audit committees about it. And, you know, it is certainly a focal area. Sometimes management sort of forgets why the auditors are asking, but there's certainly a professional responsibility to do so.
Great. Well, gentlemen, I think we are approaching the end of our broadcast. Chris, Gary, David, thank you for your excellent discussion today. It's been a pleasure joining you to share your insights on this topic. Today's broadcast will soon be available in audio format in the Virtual Museum and Archive at www.sechistorical.org. An edited transcript will be added later. Both the audio and transcript will be available under Programs and under the dedicated The Experts Forum section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank again FTI Consulting and Compass Lexicon for their generous support and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining with us today, and good afternoon.